Welcome to A Quest for Wholeness podcast. I'm your host, Lexi Burt, a fertility advisor and endometriosis advocate. Together, we're diving into the journey of understanding what it truly means to be a healthy, complete individual, biologically, psychologically, socially, and spiritually. In solo episodes, I'll share my insights on fertility, holistic health, and endometriosis. Plus, we'll have conversations with incredible guests, all exploring the same burning question: what does it mean to be a whole, healthy, and satisfied person? I'm so grateful you're here. Today's guest is James Donaldson, author, mental health advocate, and founder of the Your Gift of Life Foundation. Former NBA All-Star with the Seattle Supersonics and Dallas Mavericks, James's journey took him from the pro basketball to global tours with the Harlem Globetrotters, and eventually to a powerful mission off the court. After facing his own mental health challenges, he now dedicates his life to suicide prevention and mental wellness. His book, Celebrating Your Gift of Life, shares his inspiring story from struggle to purpose. This episode contains discussions about mental health challenges, including depression and suicide. If these topics are sensitive or triggering for you, please take care of yourself while listening. You aren't alone, and support is available. If you are in Canada, you can call or text 988 anytime for free and confidential help. In the US, you can also dial 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. I am so excited to get right into the meat and potatoes of this episode. James, your NBA career spanned 14 seasons, including an All-Star title and international play. Looking back, when did you first notice that mental health was something being neglected in professional sports, either personally or among your teammates?
Well, you know, I never really personally noticed it when I was playing, although I did see year after year after year, a lot of the guys that come to the league, they'd try out, they'd put their whole heart and soul into it, and they wouldn't make the team and they'd be devastated. And I felt for them. I mean, of course, they moved on and they went on with their life, hopefully, and found something else to get into. But you kind of run into that brick wall. I mean, after being all everything in grade school and all everything in high school and all everything in college, then you get to the pros and they say no, because there's only so many spots in that team. And you got to be really, really good and very competitive to make it. So not everybody's going to make it. A lot of the guys don't have a backup plan. They're not ready for something to kind of roll into in case this doesn't work out. And that's why I encourage the guys, hey, make sure you have a backup plan. But I saw it year after year, especially in training camp. We'd have 30, 40 guys come to camp. Only 12 were going to make the team. And so a lot of disheartened and broken spirits at the end of the camp. And I always wondered and felt, you know, for the guys and how they made out with life after the game, which is what I dedicated a lot of my post-basketball career to, is being on the board with the retired NBA players and helping them make that transition from professional sports into real everyday life again. Most of us aren't ready for it, but it's coming sooner or later, and you just have to really get yourself prepared for it.
I wonder, was mental health, was it specifically like caught in that framework back in the day when you were kind of in the NBA, or was it something that word and that idea kind of was more, aware to you after the fact?
It was after the fact. I mean, it was really stigmatized when I was playing. I played in the 80s and 90s most of my career. And so mental health wasn't something that the players talked about, the coaches, the teams. Of course, all of us are big, strong, testosterone-filled he-men. And, you know, we don't dare cry. We don't dare show weakness. We don't dare, you know, show that you're injured or anything like that. You just keep playing through it and cover it up. You put that mask on. Not good for these guys. I tell the guys out there now, it's not good. I mean, that's such a detriment to you to be so, they call it toxic masculinity now, where you just... You play that role to the hilt, you know, the strong, silent type, but never cry type. And I tell the guys, hey, it's okay to be in touch with your feelings. It's okay not to be okay and to reach out for help. I wish I had known what I know now back in the 80s and 90s, because I could have helped a lot of the guys that came through. I could have helped myself as well. I had some serious injuries that put me on the couch and knocked me out for 6 months, 8 months. And mental health was a big part of that. The depression, the loneliness, the isolation that comes, the crowd, the fans are no longer cheering. They're roaring for you every night. You're home all by yourself, and life is just totally different. So all of these things come into play, and I really hope to be able to work with a lot more athletes, especially men in particularly, because us guys are a different sort of animal that's, you know, from childhood, from boyhood, we're taught not to cry and to be tough and to suck it up. And we believe that, and we carry that into adulthood, and it starts to affect us when we start having some problems. So we have to be better prepared for that, and that's what I hope to do more and more of.
Was there ever a moment, like, during the time that you were playing in the NBA, like, you felt like you had to perform emotionally, not just physically, but, like, you were expected to be on in every kind of way?
You are. I mean, emotion is a big part of the game. Of course, physicality is the best part, biggest part of it. You have to be physically able to play in the NBA, but you have to get yourself up every game. And I think the toughest part for a lot of the guys who don't have that good balance is how to handle the tremendous highs when you win and how to handle the tremendous lows when you lose. 82 games in a season, that's a lot of highs, a lot of lows. And the playoffs roll around and everything is on, the chips are on the table, and you're playing everything for the playoffs and for that championship ring. Tremendous emotionally highs you're riding the whole time. And then, boom, it just crashes to an end if you don't walk away with that trophy. So that's the emotional part of the game. And the guys who are well-balanced, I noted I had a lot of teammates who had substance abuse problems, and they would take to drinking way too much after a win, or drinking way too much after a loss, doing drugs way too much after a win, doing drugs way too much after a loss. I mean, they just couldn't find that balance, that equilibrium. And that's the emotional part of the game that you have to be in touch with in order to perform consistently on a nightly basis like we have to.
You know, I don't know if you're a fan of hockey. I usually jump on the bandwagon at the end of the finals, but it was an American team, the Cougars, against the Edmonton Oilers last night. And you could even see that, right? Like, the Oilers had a devastating loss. They lost 1-5 last night. And you could see there were some tears the camera caught in the goalie's face, and you could see how devastating that was. And for them, that's like going to be one of their worst nights of their careers. And then you saw the celebrating team. That's going to be one of the best nights. So I think that's a good example of just those highs and lows that you just mentioned.
That's exactly right. And I mean, in one locker room, they're popping champagne and everybody's cheering. The other locker room, they're in tears, and they're just physically exhausted, emotionally exhausted. And you just don't even want to take your uniform off. It's just over. But what can you do? And so I hope more and more teams are providing the mental health support that's so crucial for these players as they go through a long season. And not only that, but to prepare them for life after the game. Because that's when the cheering really stops. That's when, you know, your identity that you had as a player, you go back to your hometown, and yeah, there might be a handful of people that know you and recognize you, but for the most part, you're just a regular average, you know, overly tall guy, but, you know, a regular average guy that nobody's cheering for you anymore. And it's hard for a lot of guys to make that adjustment.
Right, like assimilating back into civilization, essentially.
Yes, finding that purpose. What is life all about, and who am I really? For guys, especially, what we do is our identity. We really tie it into our identity. So I'm an NBA player, and that's what I'm going to be the rest of my life. Well, you're not going to be that the rest of your life. That's what you used to do. But if you still think that, I watch a lot of social media now, and guys I played with back in the 80s and 90s are still talking about the matchups and the games and things 40 years ago. I'm like, you guys have to let it go. That's way in the past. Nobody even remembers you guys now. But they talk about it as if it happened last week.
Right. Yeah. And I think you make such a good point about, you know, teams aren't, they're setting people up for the career and to make them super good players in that time frame. But in your experience in the past, or even what you know now about how that operates, is there any like offboarding process or support for these players?
Well, I'm not real familiar with it, although I'm aware that most teams, if not all teams, have a mental health counselor of some sort on the staff around the team, so the guys can reach out. This is the role I'm trying to play now with the NBA. As a former NBA player, a guy who's actually been there and done that, a lot of these mental health counselors have never dribbled a basketball. They don't know the first thing about the game. You know, so they're going to talk to the guys about the stress around there or the anxiety. But I can talk to them about, hey, actually living through this and playing through it and dealing with it myself. And so I hope I can find my way into the NBA somehow and actually work with the players and be that guy that the players can call at 3 a.m. if they just can't get to sleep. They're just so filled with anxiety and dread and anxiousness and the whole works. I've been there. I know that. I know it's part of the game. And I know I can help them more than most people can.
Absolutely. And I mean, the culture of professional sports often discourages vulnerability, right?
Yeah. Yes.
What did it take for you to start speaking publicly about your mental health? And how did that contrast with the mindset you had to maintain as an athlete?
Well, my mental health challenges came about after a series of real serious medical incidents I had with my heart. I had emergency open heart surgery to save my life back in 2015. And it was touch and go for several weeks. I was in the ICU for three months, flat on my back for the whole year. And I had to go through it again in 2016.
Wow.
So, 2 years back. And here I am up until that point. I'm still this big athlete, even though I was an older athlete. I'm in the gym 5-6 days a week. I'm running, you know, 3, 4, 5 kilometers every day and just in tip-top shape. And boom, it was all over. And so this caused me to go through this mental health spiral downhill. Depression, anxiety, suicidal thoughts, suicidal ideations, loneliness, isolation. And I went through that for a whole year. 2018 was my worst year. And so that's when I had to deal with it. Now, I was about 57, 58, 59 at the time, so after my basketball career, but still very much tied to sports and to the NBA. I mean, you know, I'm over 2 meters tall, you know, 218, I guess, in your country, 218. So people still recognize me as a basketball player. They still see me and think that I'm a basketball player. So I can't get away from it. But this really caused me. And being laid up pretty much all of 2015 and 2016, I ended up losing my long-running business I had for 30 years, physical therapy business. I ended up going through a bankruptcy, losing my life savings, all my NBA savings, losing my home in foreclosure, losing my marriage, my wife, and my stepson. Everything that could fall apart, fell apart. And everything that could leave, left. Except for my old life, which I was just, in my mind, toying with at my own fingertips and ready to throw it all away at any point. And so I went through all of that. And that's why when I finally came out of that at the end of 2018, 2019, I had this talk with God, you know, and I said, hey, God, I always took care of myself. I've always been a good guy. I've always done the right things. Why do I have to go through this? He's like, hey, James, I let you go through that so you know, and now you understand what mental health challenges are all about. You got a big platform. You know, people know you, people like you, people respect you. I want you to use your platform, get out there and speak and talk to people about mental health. Be an advocate, be a voice, help people, channel them to the resources that are available. And that has become my whole next chapter of life from 2019 on. With your Gift of Life Foundation, which I started up in 2019, and all of the work I do now with middle school and high school students and men in particular, constantly talking to them and showing them that, hey, help is readily available. You got to ask for it because mental health, like unlike most things, you can't tell something's wrong with somebody from the outside. They have to let you know. So you have to let people know that you need help, and you need them to be there for you.
You literally gave me shivers, because I think if you go through those experiences, it's really about the meaning that you take away, right? And you came out the positive side of that and found meaning in that. And I think that's where people really can impact communities and other people, is by taking their adversity and turning it into something that's going to help other people. That's a lot of work that I do in women's health. I had kind of been through the ringer with the medical system for like 12 years to finally get a diagnosis and find treatments and support that work. And I feel almost responsible to be able to share this information with other people, because it's like, maybe it doesn't have to be like that for everybody.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, sometimes you just don't know until you have to go through it yourself. And then you come out being that advocate and that voice and on fire, spread the word and help other people out. And that's exactly what I've been doing and what I plan to do the rest of my life. My long-running business is over with. You know, I have to rebuild my nest egg, got to find another girlfriend who can be my wife one day. I got to rebuild everything from the start, but I'm still here to be able to do that.
What was something that you learned about yourself going through really the darkest times of your life with your mental health?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I've always been a man of faith. I grew up in a Christian home, and I really have a strong sense of faith, and God is real and God is in control. And so I knew all along that, even though I was going through a real difficult time, that God wasn't so much putting me through it. He was allowing me to go through it. He was waiting for me at the other end, saying, hey, come on. You're learning a lesson. I'm teaching you a lesson. I'm going to equip you with all you need to get out there and make a difference in the world. And so it was tough. It was 12 months of, I say, pure darkness and hell, 2018. Where some days I didn't think I'd make it to tomorrow. Some days I didn't think I'd make it to the next hour. But I had a small group of friends, 5, 6 real intimate close friends. And I asked them all, I said, hey guys, I need you to check in on me 2 or 3 times a week. Just call me and ask me how my day's going. And I need you to allow me to call you at 2 or 3 in the morning if I need to. And they all put their hand up, say, yes, 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 call. You know? That made a big difference, having a support group around me. And we all need a support group, even if it's just 1 or 2 people. You've got to have that person that you can go to. And these little phones that we're talking about, they're not going to do it. They're not going to cut it. Yeah, they got all these apps and things for mental health and meditations and calm and everything else, but it's not the same as talking to a real live person who's actually looking you in the eye, or taking you by the arm, or giving you a hug. That makes all the difference.
Well said. I think that's the thing. We live in North America, where we are. We're really in this epidemic of loneliness. We're more connected than we've ever been in history, but we're experiencing the highest levels of isolation and loneliness, which I think are contributing to these mental health crises that we're really seeing all across the board.
Yeah, I really agree with that. And I blog every single day also about mental health and different articles and things. And I blogged out what the U.S. Surgeon General said 2 or 3 years ago about loneliness.
That's right.
Being the number one epidemic in this country. I mean, it's mental health is way up there, but loneliness is above that. And so many of us, I really feel for our kids now, because our kids are just living their whole life through this little phone gadget in their hand. They just can't put it down. They can't look up from it. And, you know, studies show now that a lot of kids are up to 12 hours a day on social media platforms. 12 hours. I mean, you're trying to go to school for 4 or 5 hours. You're trying to eat for an hour or two. You should be out playing with your friends for a few hours, but they're on their phones for 12 hours a day on average. And I feel for them as they get a little bit older, into their 20s, and they got to go out and find that first little girlfriend or first little boyfriend, and they won't be able to talk to them. without texting to them right across the table, you know, it's not going to work very well.
I think about that often, particularly like 2 or 3 years ago, I guess 3 years ago now, there was a whistleblower came out about Meta's data about teenage girls on social media and mental health, comparing, you know, body image like issues. Yeah. And I was thinking, it made me really angry. And I even notice it. I'm 29, but I notice when I'm on those platforms too much, I can feel this depression come in and this comparison, and I'm feeling bad about my body. I have a fully developed frontal lobe, mm-hmm. and I'm recognizing that. And there's children who don't even have these cognitive capacities developed. And it's really frightening to see where that might go when they've been indoctrinated by these tools from so early on.
Yes, yes, it's scary. Very, very scary.
I want to ask as well, because you're such an advocate for, you know, suicide prevention. And when we talk about even the word suicide, there's a lot of stigma around it. And before we hit record, we were talking about how, you know, suicidal ideations isn't something that's abnormal. It doesn't mean you're broken, and it doesn't mean that there's something wrong with you. So I'm wondering, when you're speaking about, you know, suicidality, suicidal ideations, and suicide prevention, what is kind of the vibe that you are receiving or experiencing from people?
Well, you know, my presentation and talks are received very, very well from the middle school and high school kids that I speak to all around the state of Washington. Although YouTube just pulled down one of my videos.
Of course.
I know, like, come on. Because it said it violated their term or condition or something. I was, even though it's made for kids, I checked the box, made for kids. I'm speaking to the kids about, you know, suicide and possibly taking your life and reaching out for help. YouTube thought I violated their term, so they took that video down. I still got dozens of other videos up there saying the same thing, but they took this one down. But the kids appreciate the fact that you're straight shooting, straight talking. You're not dancing around, you know. And at the end of my talks, I usually have questions and answers for the kids. And there's always three or four kids in the audience that will tell you that they're suicidal right now. And they'll say it in front of their peers, especially in a small town, small school settings. They'll say it in front of their peers and let everybody know that they're really struggling. The transgender things that kids are going through, the gender identity things that kids are going through, the bullying that kids are going through, the body shaming and all these things that kids go through, they are really struggling with these things. And so I'm a straight shooter and straight talk with them. I just let them know that, hey, I've been through all these things I'm talking about, and you might go through them too, but I made it through. And you will too. But I reached out for help. And you must reach out for help. And so that's how I like to talk to them. And they really, really I'm more than just, you know, the school counselor or the school principal holding the school assembly, and they're just rolling their eyes over it. They see me come through and they're like, wow, that's James. And, you know, he's bigger than life. You know, he's right here. And I have a whole little video that plays, and it's got some little basketball highlights in there, but mainly it's telling my story of how from the great heights I was at to the great lows I went to, and then be able to work my way back up. This is life, and it may happen to you, and if it does, let's get you as best prepared as we can.
I'm sure they really appreciate being spoken to straight up, because I think, you know, just as we infantilize older adults, right, and talk to them like babies, and we talk to children like they don't really get it, they get it. Yeah. They get it, and they want someone to talk to them. Yes. Respectfully, like an adult.
That's exactly right. That's right. And my little video shows that I actually went through these things, you know, so it's not like I'm just talking and a little rah-rah motivational, inspirational, like I used to do way back in the day. Before I knew about this stuff, now I'm in there with real life experience and sharing that with them, backing it up with a nice video that's playing, and they're really into it. And then I let them ask questions, whatever questions they have. And a lot of them, you know, kids being kids, they don't have the filters on that us grownups do. So,
well, what kind of questions, if you don't mind sharing, or do you kind of like commonly receive or what has been some surprising ones?
Well, you know, they'll ask me about, you know, things like some of the ways I thought about killing myself. And that's, it's still touchy. It's, I'm getting emotional now. It's still touchy to talk about those things. Because that was a place in my life and a whole different mindset I was in. I would never think about that now. But to think about the fact that I thought about those things, I write about it in my book. And I tell people, hey, I had my plan all planned out. All I had to do was just execute it. Every once in a while, I got that impulsive voice in my head that kept telling me, James, go ahead and do it. Just do it. You got it all mapped out. You got your plan ready. Do it. And I'm like, whoa, I got to fight this voice off. I got to get this out of my head. And that was the toughest part of that whole 12-month journey I went through, to get that little voice out of your head, especially at 2 or 3 in the morning. When it hits you most, and when you're all by yourself and you can't get back to sleep. So I share with these kids that, hey, that's what I went through, and I don't have anything holding back from you. And so, you know, we talk about it. We have some laughs during the talk, but we also have some tears and some crying. And most of the time I end up crying, but they're crying right along with me.
It sounds like, just like we were talking about, you know, with professional athletes, like these highs and the lows, right? Even in your presentations with these kids, there's the highs and the lows. And then it's like, how do we get back to equilibrium?
Yeah.
And it's funny that we're having this conversation. I always find in interviews I do, there's always a common theme that kind of ends up emerging through our conversations. Mm-hmm. And this morning I was thinking about, you know, I deal with a lot of chronic health, right? And it was just like you were saying about suicide or even depression, right? You look fine. You don't look sick. And I think that happens a lot with some invisible chronic health diseases. And I was thinking about how I don't think it's always avoiding those low points or trying to stay at all the high points, but it's how do you get back on the horse once things have, you know, gone awry, or once they've been really good, because you're not going to stay up there the whole time, but it's how do you bring yourself back to balance? And I think that's a really underrated skill that we don't talk a lot about, is getting back to equilibrium and kind of back to that baseline.
Yeah. And unfortunately, with so many of us living socially isolated lives, we don't have a lot of role models to emulate. We don't have a lot of mentors to walk us through these things. Not readily available. We have to search them out. Whereas growing up back in the day, you know, we had our parents, we had our neighbors, we had the village raising us. Everybody was part of our life. Kids don't have that anymore. And so it's really more on them. The onus is on the kids to reach out for help and let people know they're not okay at the moment, but we can get you back to being okay again with some help.
If your 25-year-old self could sit in on one of these school talks today about mental health and suicide prevention, what do you think he would find surprising or even hard to believe?
Wow, I would have never imagined I would have gone through something like this, for one thing. 25, I was on top of the world. I was in the NBA. I'd run all day, jump all day. You know, everything was just picture perfect. I couldn't have dreamed of a better existence. But, you know, you never know how life is going to give you those twists and turns or throw you that curveball that you just can't even get the bat off your shoulder to hit it. Boom. And your life can turn upside down at a moment. What I tell a lot of folks about me is that, you know, you don't have to do a lot of bad things for bad things to happen in life. Sometimes life just happens. Especially when it's health related or financial related, relationship related. I mean, people go through breakups and divorces all the time. There's a lot of heartbreak with that. So there's a lot of things we can't control, but there's a whole bunch of things in life we can't control. And so you have to just be able to hang on that little piece that you can control and make sure that you're the best you can be at that moment, get through whatever you're going through.
That's well put. That makes me think of this story a client shared with me the other day. She's a fertility client trying to achieve pregnancy and had a miscarriage. And she's a NICU nurse. And she had to take some time off, right, from work, but you still got to go back to your job seeing babies. How devastating, right? Yeah. And I said, wow, that must have been really hard. How did you manage that time? And she said it was quite healing for her because she realized we can control these things that we can do. We can eat healthy. We can be kind, can be generous, can exercise, you know, be socially involved. But there's this other aspect that we can't control. And she said she realized that when she saw babies come in who were addicted to heroin. The mother never had prenatal care, but the babies were full-term healthy. And then there was the parents who did all of the prenatal care. They were eating healthy before trying to conceive, and their baby, you know, was ill upon delivery. And she said that's when she realized that there's this thing that we can't quite control, and that's okay. We can do our best and control the things that we can. But there's just things that happen.
Yeah. Life does happen. And, you know, you don't have to be a drug addict or alcoholic or doing devastating things to your life. And bad things happen to them, too. But when you're doing the best you can to be the best you can and things still happen, it seems like life's not fair sometimes. But, you know, these are the challenges that come with the journey that we're on. And that challenge is to make it through. Pick yourself up. And dust yourself off and keep on going.
James, were you this empathetic before your mental health crisis, or do you feel like you developed a lot more empathy? Because I feel like you're a very intuitive and kind person.
Yeah, well, much more than ever before. Much more empathetic, much more sympathetic after going through what I've gone through. You know, being an athlete, I was very competitive. So I was one of the guys. I'd push myself. I'd push the rest of the guys. You know, we'd rib each other if we start crying or you fall down or you double over because you got hit in the stomach. You know, hey, no, you don't do that. You just keep on playing. Don't worry about it. I learned a whole bunch going through my mental health experience because now I see how people who talk about mental health challenges, how they feel or how they must feel. I empathize with them right away. Whether it's, you know, dealing with bullying at school or going through a divorce or financial. I mean, I've been through most of these things already and I know intuitively now how they must be feeling. And I encourage them to talk to me about it or talk to somebody about it because, hey, it's the loneliest feeling in the world when you're on that mental health island, that mental health challenge island all by yourself, because you feel like you're all by yourself. You know, you.
Your mind tricks you. It lies to you, as in fact, actually, and it says nobody wants to help you. Nobody wants to listen to you. So you just keep it to yourself. But it's a lie.
Yes. It is a lie. Yeah. And you feel like actually nobody cares. I mean, in my little video I show the kids, I'm sitting there, I talk about my scenario, I'm talking with my family physician, sitting 6 feet away from him. And he said, James, if you take your life, people are going to miss you. People care about you. People love you. And I looked back at him as serious can be. I said, Doc, nobody's going to miss me. Nobody cares about me. Nobody loves me. And that's exactly how I felt. Now I know better. Now I know people love me. People care about me. People are going to miss me. But back then, 2018, I was ready to check out any day.
Going through any sort of mental health crisis, especially an elongated one, you develop skills, right? And things to add to your toolbox. What's something in your toolbox now that really supports you when things get tough?
Yeah, well, I keep my faith going. My faith in God is really paramount, you know. Nightly prayers to the man upstairs. Journaling is a big part of my day. Every night I journal how my day went so I can recollect these experiences months down the road, years down the road. And also having a good friend or two nearby, almost on a daily basis, making sure that I can talk with them, that I can be with them, that I can share with them what I'm going through. I've got two or three little groups of men friends that we meet. There's a Tuesday group, there's a Thursday group, there's a Saturday group. We meet for breakfast. And to be able to talk with guys especially, you know, guys are a little different when the women aren't around. You know,
we
can actually lay it out there and talk. And that's so helpful for me and for them too.
Well, what would you tell young men these days? I'm curious on finding those groups or those connections, because again, like we were talking about with the kids and even us as adults, it's so easy to get sucked into this isolation and just being online, playing video games. And especially for young men in North America, again, it's a common trend where there's this more, isolation and internalization. What would you say to those young men?
Well, I encourage them to make sure they have a good friend in their life. Most men are lone wolves. You know, we go at it by ourselves. We end up isolated. We might give a relationship a good try, but if it works, great. If it doesn't, well, you're out there hitting the bars and the single scene and the strip joints and the gambling halls and doing all these detrimental behaviors that just don't serve you well. And that's because he doesn't really have a good friend in his life that he can lean on and talk to. And so that's the most important thing. I was blessed and still am blessed to have tremendous role models in my life. Most of my old basketball coaches who are 20 years older than I am, they're in their mid-80s now, late 80s, and I still talk with them all the time. And, you know, they help me tremendously just by their experience, by their wisdom, by their encouragement to keep on hanging in there. I remember my old university coach told me, he said, hey, his life didn't really turn for the better, even though he was a very successful college basketball coach. He really hit success when he hit 63 years of age. And he said, James, you haven't got started yet. I'm like, wow, thank you, coach. You know, and it gives you something to look forward to. It gives you something to say, wow, I get to that point and boom, it's never too late. Life can be so much better as we keep on plugging away and keep on working at it.
I love that. 63, you know, that gives us a lot of years to look forward to.
He went to work for Nike and became a big Nike global ambassador for Nike, one of Phil Knight's right-hand men. And I mean, he had a successful coaching career for 40 years, but he never really got to the highest height of coaching, winning championships. And then he moves over to Nike and boom, his whole world opened up.
That's so cool. That is so cool. I mean, on that note too, you said you were once the guy who had it all, a career, the success, businesses. How do you define having it all now? And has that definition changed kind of post-depression?
Well, you know, I was never very materialistic, even though I did have material trappings, you know, but I didn't have multiple cars and multiple houses and multiple everything. I had a nice car, I had a nice house, had a wonderful wife. But, you know, back then, I think, again, my identity defined me so much. I was a former professional NBA player. I was a business owner. I was a community leader. I was very involved with, you know, everything in town. And so that all kind of went away when I went through my depression. I kind of retracted somewhat on my own. And I just didn't feel like those things were still within my reach. And so I've been able to come back out and remake myself, minus the house, minus the money, minus the wife, minus the family, minus everything, except for my own sense of who I am and what my new purpose in life is. And a purpose is something you just get up in the morning, you're just going at it. I mean, like I did with basketball, like I did with business, like I've done with everything, running my Gift of Life Foundation and helping people with mental health challenges is really, really my new passion. And it's something I get up in the morning, I'm raring to go, I'm shooting my blogs off, I'm doing my social media posts, I'm speaking at schools, I'm everywhere doing this kind of thing. And that's my true sense of my new passion, my new purpose. And that's the title of my book, Celebrating Your Gift, From the Verge of Suicide Back to a Life of Purpose and Joy. Purpose and Joy.
Have you heard of the term, Japanese term, ikigai?
I don't think so.
It's basically that thing that gets you up in the morning, that thing that gives you energy and gives you purpose. And we all need to have that ikigai in our lives, or else what's the point, right? Yeah. If you don't have that thing driving you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. No, that's so true. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't have a purpose in life. I mean, they get up, they punch the clock at work from 8 to 5. They go back home, in commuting traffic for an hour or two. They just don't realize. They don't really have much of a purpose. And I think it's paramount to find a reason that you're here. What are you going to make of this existence that we all have for these 70, 80, 90 years, whatever you're going to be here? You got to make them count, because they do go by pretty quickly.
Yeah. And, I think just people going through a mental health experience, you really learn to figure out, okay, what do I want to make my purpose? Because we aren't just predestined to something. You get to choose. And it doesn't have to be something grand. You don't have to be like, my purpose is to only be an NBA player and that's it. Yeah. It could be to tend to the garden in your yard, right? To be a caretaker of plants. Like, it doesn't have to be something so successful and extreme, but just something that when you wake up in the morning, you're like, I get to do that. And I think that's so exciting.
That's right. Whatever brings you joy, that purpose and joy is success for everybody. And it's for everybody. So find what that is, pursue it, and do it with gusto.
I love it. So, James, when you walk into a school or youth group now, what do you hope young people hear most clearly from your story? What do you say to them that makes them stop scrolling and start listening?
Well, being over 7 feet tall, all eyes are on me when I walk into a middle school. So it's good. That's a good attention grabber, So I command attention when I get in there. But I think more than anything, because there's so many stereotypes that come with professional athletes. You live in a big gated mansion up on the hill, away from everybody else. You've got half a dozen cars in the driveway. There's stereotypes, money that's just flowing off of you. Well, that's true for a very few guys, but not most of the guys. And the kids buy into that too, because they see it all on social media. This is what they think and they believe. And so I want to show them that, yes, I was a very, very good basketball player. I was very successful at it. But, along came some serious medical issues that really derailed me in my life. And I put myself back on the track of getting back on my feet again. And these things happen in life, nothing's guaranteed. So I show them that, hey, I had it all. I'm working on rebuilding it all again. I'm making some good progress doing that. And you kids can do the same. So no matter what you're going through right now, you might be bullied, you might be laughed at, you might feel awkward and socially inept. Keep going through it. Be the best you can be. Be a little bit better tomorrow.
There you go. I think, you made a good point. Your height makes people stop, the kids stop scrolling.
It does too. That really does.
That's a good one. James, if people have questions or want to learn more about you or connect with you, where's the best place that they can do that?
Best place you can catch up with me is through my foundation, which is yourgiftoflife.org, which is my website. My email address is jamesd, like Donaldson, jamesd@yourgiftoflife.org. Please shoot me an email. I always respond to them. I've even got a secondary phone number up there that I answer. And if people need to talk to me, need to call me, I always put this out for the guys that are listening. Because a lot of these guys, they do call. They won't talk to their girlfriend or their wife or their doctor, but they want to talk to me. And I'm like, cool, hey, let's talk. And I've helped a lot of them back from the verge of suicide and just really throwing their lives away. So, guys, if you're listening out there and you need somebody to talk to, give me a call. I'd be more than happy to talk with you. So you can reach out to me on those couple means. My book is available on the website as well. You're celebrating your gift of life. I personally autograph and sign everyone and drop it back in the mail to you. So get it through my link, or you can pick it up on Amazon or, you know, Books a Million or Barnes & Noble and all the rest of those things too. They're not going to find a nice little note in there for you, but I will.
So go to the website is what he's saying.
go to the website.
I'll have all of that linked up in the show notes if listeners want to connect or touch base. And thank you so much for blessing us with this conversation, James.
Lexi, this has just been fabulous. Thank you so, so very much. It's been a real pleasure. I never know what to expect when I'm coming on somebody's show. But hey, this is just fantastic. It worked out perfectly. Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode. I hope you feel inspired and empowered to embrace your whole self in mind, body, and spirit. If you're ready to take the next step in understanding your fertility or women's health needs, I would love to support you. Book a free consult with me, and together we'll explore how we can work towards your healthiest, most vibrant self. Until next time, take care.